Last year, Dan Harper led a service about the service, its elements, and what each one is for. When he came to speak of the sermon, he said a few wise things, and then suggested that I, as the minister responsible for most of the preaching in this congregation, might have some more things to say. Well, I do. There are many, many purposes of the sermon. I could fill this time just with a list, but I'll just throw a few out there. To provide insight, to give some food for thought, to give hope and comfort and perspective, a new way of looking at things, to infuse the congregation with a sense of determination and purpose to tackle the problems life presents them, to dance along the edge of congregation members' lives, meeting them where they are and urging them a bit further on. A friend of mine who was not an attendee of any church talked to me about this when I was in seminary because she found it strange that we put a sermon at the center of our services. Why, she wondered, should people listen and ponder while another person talks and talks? She said a sadhu, a Hindu holy person, doesn't give a 20-minute address. That's not the center of their worship. Of course, I could have said there are traditions besides Christianity and its offshoots like us where a lengthy address by one person is common. Judaism's Devar Torah, the word about Torah, a Buddhist Dharma talk, for example. But that wouldn't have answered the question that I think she was really asking, which was, where does the authority to preach come from? Not why listen to words, but why listen to this person's words? And that is a crucial question with which any preacher with integrity must grapple, not just in seminary, but over and over, preferably every Sunday. So let's just say, there is nothing in the minister's life, my life, nor any minister I have ever known, and I've known hundreds, some incredible, amazing people and speakers, nothing that makes us uniquely qualified to give a sermon. Which is a major reason that we arrange things here at UUCPA so that others give about 30% of the sermons, so that we hear other voices. And in the service as well, usually with worship associates, and I'll make a pitch. I really, really hope that if you have ever thought that looks like an interesting thing, that you'll fill out an application and talk to me about being a worship associate next year. People really want to hear from more than just one person. I know not only people out in the world, but people right in this congregation who are my moral exemplars, who live with a wisdom and a grace to which I as yet only aspire. There are people right here who have done things as interesting or more interesting than anything I have done. I, the person charged with 70% of the preaching, they bring more years of life than I do to their wisdom. And they bring reflection from a fascinating variety of experiences. Now, sure, a big part of the sermon, as with any art form, is the craft of it, that facility with language that one hones over years of practice. One can have a great deal of life wisdom and fascinating things to say and not have honed that craft. But like many things, it can be learned by almost anyone who is willing to put in the time and effort, and whose minister is willing to help, as I am. Most of us, having put in all that time and effort, still won't end up preaching like Martin Luther King Jr., or developing ideas with the depth of Ralph Waldo Emerson, or evoking feelings with the poetry of Toni Morrison. But we can articulate our observations about life in a way that will reach others' minds and hearts. In other words, as with any art form, craft will only take you so far. You can compose something lovely, a well-balanced, graceful structure of words, just as a painter can create a likeness, and a composer can put together notes in a way that's pleasing to the ear, for them to be infused with soul, for the sermon, in short, to be a sermon, not just a collection of words or proverbs. A sermon, furthermore, that is worth people's time, 20 precious minutes of our time allotted to our lives. It needs to stand on two supports. It must speak out of the preacher's lived experience, and I mean by the preacher anyone who is in the pulpit, professional, volunteer, professional in some other field, because all of us have lived experience. It must speak out of that experience, and it must speak to the congregation's needs. So, to the first. Okay, the answer, Jeopardy style, is who is Barzilai Frost? The question, which traveled the rounds of the students preparing for the Unitarian Universalist ministry in my seminary, is the name of the preacher Emerson speaks about in his Divinity School address, the famous essay on the purpose of preaching that was given right here in one of our campus buildings. Poor Barzilai would probably rather that his name, which Emerson himself did not give, vanish into obscurity, because this is what Emerson had to say about him. I once heard a preacher who sorely tempted me to say I would go to church no more. A snowstorm was falling around us. The snowstorm was real, the preacher merely spectral. And the eye felt the sad contrast in looking at him and then out of the window behind him into the beautiful meteor of the snow. He had lived in vain. He had no one word intimating that he had laughed or wept, was married or in love, had been commended or cheated or chagrined. If he had ever lived and acted, we were none the wiser for it. The capital secret of his profession, namely to convert life into truth, he had not learned. Not one fact in all his experience had he yet imported into his doctrine. Not a line did he draw out of real history. The true preacher can be known by this, that he deals out to the people his life, life passed through the fire of thought. But of the bad preacher, it could not be told from his sermon what age of the world he fell in, whether he had a father or a child, whether he was a freeholder or a pauper, whether he was a citizen or a countryman, or any other fact of his biography. It seemed strange that the people should come to church. It seemed as if their houses were very unentertaining, that they should prefer this thoughtless clamor. There's a paradox at work here, that the preacher's job is what Lincoln conceived his to be at the bloody battlefield of Gettysburg, in which he succeeded so beautifully, as Morrison writes. In disclaiming his ability to match in words what the soldiers did on that field, he humbly signals deference to the uncapturability of the life his language mourns. He was right. Morrison is right. Language reaches towards the ineffable, the inexpressible, but cannot pin it down. Maybe that's why formalists like Barzilai Frost got so stuck. They sensed that what they were trying to communicate was just too great. And so they stepped back, hiding their lives from their congregations. I don't know. It's all I know about him. The other side of the paradox is that expressing our experience through language is what we do. We put a sermon at the center of most of our services because we trust that language does have a power to reach for the ineffable. All we have for material, any of us who preach, are our lives and language, which is inadequate to encompass them. A dilemma for any honest person who dares to step into the pulpit or sit up here and speak. I think Lincoln's humility is the key for the preacher as well. I'm not sure Emerson shared that sense of the inherent limits of the preacher's task. Maybe he believed that we could, in the end, convert life into truth through our words. I tend to agree with Morrison that any such attempt inevitably fails in some way. And yet, please note that in the very words we heard, with no false humility, she is accepting the recognition offered her. The literary world's most exalted way to tell a writer, you have indeed converted life into truth for us. And anyway, didn't I say from this very spot a few weeks ago that attempting the impossible is a noble and important task? And so I enter this pulpit week after week to deal you out my life passed through the fire of thought. If that's the job of the sermon, then the first duty of the preacher is to live. To live and reflect on living, so that they can then share with the vulnerability of honesty and the wisdom of careful selection fragments gleaned from that life. Now, it's really important to note that one might do that without ever using the word I. It's possible we've overcompensated a little, having read Emerson's warning, generation after generation of preacher, because sometimes sermons seem to be all about the person in the pulpit, and you know what? That also makes them unreal, inaccessible to others. Not as real and tangible as the whirling snow. But it's been my observation as a preacher and a member of a congregation that all effective sermons, even without, maybe especially without that one short, arrogantly capitalized word, I, are in first person singular. They come from us. They can do no other if they are to be genuine. And so, to be neither a Barzilai Frost nor a self-absorbed confessor, either way inaccessible to those who listen for some word of wisdom and help, requires humility, the humility of knowing oneself to be always in process and imperfect, simply trying to invite other travelers along the path of thought. And, along with that humility, confidence that this is worthwhile, that the preacher's own life can illuminate others through language. So that's to the first part. The second part, speaking to the congregation's needs, is just as essential. Here I follow a process, I haven't always done this, but I learned to. Followed a process outlined by a wonderful preacher and writer named Kay Northcutt, who describes preaching to a congregation as group spiritual direction. Now, you might not know what individual spiritual direction is, although this is an important thing to know. We now have a community minister who is studying to be a spiritual director, Reverend Stephanie Etzbach-Dale. So I will give a no doubt inadequate definition from my own experience in spiritual direction, which is spiritual direction is kind of like therapy, one-on-one therapy, except where therapy deals with the questions of emotion and psychology, mental questions. Spiritual direction deals with spiritual questions. So one might go to one's spiritual direction, the spiritual director, because one is stuck in grief or indecision, because one has a moral dilemma, or has resolved a past moral dilemma in a way that leaves one burdened with shame and uncertainty, because we have questions about the meanings of our lives or what will happen to us after we die, we may come to a spiritual director. And for a minister, for me, my spiritual director is kind of my minister. Because although I have wonderful ministers among my colleagues, including right here, when I come to church every week, none of them is my minister. She's my minister. Well, so Kay Northcutt says that when one is preparing a sermon, one has to concentrate not only on the text And she preaches from a lectionary tradition, preaching a portion of the Bible each week, so she has a text. Not only from what one has decided to preach about or what was going on in the world or the life the life of the larger community, but one asks the question, what do the people coming in this door need right now? Now you can see the catch right away. A spiritual director asked that about one client at a time. How does one do spiritual direction with an entire group of people, very few of whom have actually even communicated what they need that week or at all? So there's tremendous variety in the room every week. I beg your patience because not every sermon will speak exactly to your needs the way a one-on-one spiritual director ought to do. But that is the question I ask myself. What are the concerns I have heard from the people here? What am I seeing in your faces and body language? What am I hearing when you talk about the world outside? What are you bringing into your heart and fretting over? This is why I never run out of topics to speak about. I don't have that problem at all. There's always an answer there. So again, just as I said, the sermon is ultimately about the preacher. It's also ultimately about you, whoever is here. But again, as with the preacher, not because you are the center of the universe any more than the preacher is, but because where you are at this moment is the place from which we must go forward. We can do no other. Now, I did say congregation, not audience, an important thing to note. Although there is a great deal about a Protestant-style church service that is like what happens in a theater, from the arrangement of the room, right? Here I am up here, slightly elevated, so you can see and hear me, and sort of a stage and an audience. If we had an amphitheater seating, I would be below you, but still set apart. We even kind of have a proscenium here. And of course, what happens in the course of the service has an arc, a drama, a beginning, and a close, just like elements of the theater. But we don't say audience. If we do, we're slipping. Because this is not just about listening and passively receiving. It is an active process. Now, of course, thoughtful actors, dancers, musicians, directors, choreographers, and composers want more from the people in the chairs than passive listening as well. Every act of art is a dialogue. Even when the audience's response is given no voice but applause and the occasional murmur or sigh or laugh, what happens inside the minds of those sitting here is as important as what emanates from here. But these artists, the composers, the choreographers, the singers, they are burdened with that unfortunate term, audience, meaning hearers, meaning those who hear. They have to turn to new words to express a desire for more interactive art. One of our members, Bear Capron, shared with me that in the Netherlands, when he did theater that was intended to be interactive, they used the word deelnemers, participants. That's a lot better, but it's not the usual word, right, for a theater audience. It's audience, or spectators, those who look. We in church are lucky. Our word already carries that sense of participation. And it's really important. This is not just an interesting fact of language. You and I, when I'm fortunate to be spending a service listening to the sermon rather than just delivering it, are members of a congregation. And I'm saying that of all of us here, whether you've actually signed the membership book or are a friend of UUCPA or are visiting a church for the very first time and already have it in your mind never to come again, or are a guest musician, this, right here, those of us gathered for this hour, this is a congregation. It is a network of relationships. And what we are doing here is relational, or else it doesn't work. Which brings us to the third leg on which the sermon stands, I said there were only two, but, you know, stools don't stand very well on two. This is the third. There's the preacher's own life through the fire of thought and conveyed with humility. There's the congregation's life in all its diversity, taken seriously. And there is the relationship among the people gathered, which itself extends into the past, to people long gone, into the future, those we will never meet, around the globe, to humans and non-humans and non-living things. We here are a snippet of the great web of relationships. That, I think, is a really big part of why we have a sermon and what makes it work, if it works. That awareness that the tendrils extend far beyond in space and time. Because no, not every sermon will meet you exactly where you are right this moment, or speak in your theological language, or deal with something that you have been wrestling with lately. What is said here any given week might be right on the money for a particular person, speaking to a dilemma that you, singular you, are facing this moment, or a sorrow you bear, or an intention you, singular you, are trying to flesh out. And when you hear one of those sermons, it's special. I bet you remember a few of those, as I do, and treasure the memories of those mornings. That the sermon will speak to needs you didn't know you had. That speak to someone else whom you are connected with, whom you understand only because you are both beads in Indra's wondrous net of creation, the vibrating web of mutuality that connects everything. When I've been sitting there in this church, in one of these chairs, in a church built on a long arm of land extending into another ocean far away, in a drab convention center ballroom, when I've been sitting in one of these chairs, in one of those places, and heard a sermon that rocked my world, that changed my life, I left trembling with a need I didn't know I had, a burning desire to address it, and a strong sense of how to begin to do so. That was possible only because the preacher was speaking to something that someone else needed. That made sense to them. And so that sense of wonder and transformation is born of the connections among us all, the fact that we are all connected. And it is the transformation that I hope the sermon most weeks will work in you. Really, what all of these three things depend upon, what connects them, what brings them together in the sermon, is this essentiality of language to which Toni Morrison addresses herself with such power, humility, and eloquence. What we are trying to do together requires ultimately that we bring our entire selves and set ourselves aside. That we know we are inadequate to the task and everything we have, our lives, our reflections, the thought that is the fire through which we pass these little lives, the language that we have crafted to use, all of them only reach towards but never grasp everything we feel, everything we would like to know and express. This is true of the preacher, it is true of the congregation, it is true of the web of relationships, and the fact that we are all here nevertheless doing it together makes it possible that we will be transformed, that we will feel and know that ineffable inexpressible truth. When we feel that, we come back again and again because the 20 minutes, they just fly by. Now, with gratitude for our